Okay, it's study night. It's October 27th, and we're studying Diligently Seeking God. This will be session 7 of this study, and we're going to read about the adventures of Abram, who will later be known as Abraham. But in the chapters that we'll be reading from Genesis, starting in Genesis chapter 13, he's still called Abram. Now, Genesis 13, 1 says, "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south." It's an interesting verse because in our way of thinking of geography, we think of going down to the south, right? But he went up out of Egypt into the south. So some things we need to understand about geography in the times of the Bible is that they didn't have printed maps back then. We think of north is up and south is down because the way it's printed on the maps. When it talks about going up, it's talking about elevation, not the direction that you're going. Because when you look at the map, where he went to was east and a little bit north of Egypt. It wasn't directly up north, but he did go to a higher elevation. And the word south is the Hebrew word Negeb, and it means south, but it's referring to an area that was the southern part of the land of Canaan, where Abram had been. So he went up by elevation out of Egypt, which is lower ground, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, and he went into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. Now, if you remember what happened in the previous chapter, God had told Abram to go into the land of Canaan. He had been living in Ur of the Chaldees and then Haran, which is the northern part of the land of Canaan. And he went into the land of Canaan, and all of a sudden there's a famine, a severe drought. And he had a lot of cattle and sheep and stuff that need grass to eat. So he went to Egypt, where it wasn't a drought, where the Nile River meets the Mediterranean Sea. It's always good grazing land, so he went there. And remember also that he was concerned that the Egyptians might see how beautiful his wife is and want to kill him to get his wife. I found a note in the Companion Bible. The Companion Bible is the King James Version with notes of E.W. Bullinger, who lived in the 1800s. And he had a lot of notes in the Bible. And one of his notes said that in Egypt, the women did not wear veils. Whereas in the Middle East, even back then as they do now, they wear veils over their faces. So the reason why he may have been very concerned that someone might want to kill him for his wife was because his wife was so beautiful, nobody would know in the land of Canaan if all the women wore veils. But in Egypt, where they didn't wear veils, she would stand out as a stunningly attractive woman, and he might be in danger of losing his life over her. So he told her, "Tell everybody you're my sister," which was true because she was a half-sister, had the same father but a different mother. I don't believe it was he didn't trust God. He didn't trust the Egyptians. He didn't trust the people. So the king of Egypt heard about how beautiful this woman was and wanted Sarah to be his wife and treated Abram very well, gave him a lot of silver and gold and cattle and stuff in exchange for his supposed sister. And it was God that plagued him and his family and let him know that Sarah was Abram's wife. So the king of Egypt let Sarah go back to Abram. He didn't ask for all the stuff back that he had given him. So now Abram's wealth has increased. And it's interesting because Abram didn't go where he went in an effort to increase his wealth. That wasn't his ambition. It just happened that way because God was taking care of him, and he wound up with a whole lot more silver and gold and animals. And in that time, a man's animals was considered a large part of his wealth. So he was now very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold without trying to be rich, without working towards being rich. What he was working towards was doing the will of God. And it was really God that enriched him. This will come up again later on. Verse 3, "And he went on his journeys from the south," or the Negeb region, "even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now, Bethel is interesting because Bethel means house of God. The area was called Bethel by Abram's grandson, Jacob, when Jacob was there. It says that the town was originally called Luz, and you'll see that in chapter 28, Genesis 28, verse 19. It says, and this is regarding Jacob, says, and he called the name of that place Bethel, means house of God. But the name of that city was called Luz, L-U-Z, at the first. So the time that Abram was there, it was called Luz. But in the narrative, it says Bethel, because this was written by Moses over 400 years after the fact. And at the time it was written, it was known as Bethel. And everybody that would be reading this would recognize the city as Bethel rather than Luz as it had previously been. So that would be why it says he went to Bethel. And he went unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. That's Jehovah. Now there are a couple of translations that word this differently as far as Abram called on the name of the Lord. Let me show you. There's a feature of eSword where you can compare Bible versions, and I have maybe 20 or so versions of the Bible here that I can compare it with. And most of them say that Abram called on the name of the Lord. But look at this YLT, that's Young's Literal Translation. And it says, unto the place of the altar which he made there at the first, and there doth Abram preach in the name of Jehovah. You see that? Instead of call upon the name of the Lord, it says he does preach in the name of Jehovah. There's another one that gives a similar reading, the LSV, and that's the Literal Standard Version, which is a recent translation done in 2020. It says, to the place of the altar which he made there at the first, and there Abram preaches in the name of Yahweh. Yahweh is the same as Jehovah. But I think it's interesting that at least a couple of them would say he was preaching in the name of the Lord as opposed to calling upon the name of the Lord, because Abram was referred to by God as a prophet, right? A prophet speaks for God. So it's very likely that while he was at Bethel there was a city, and he preached to the people about God. He could also preach to his household about God. He had many, many servants, hundreds of them. So he was one who spoke for God. Now, verse 5 says, and Lot also, that's his nephew, whose father had died, and Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. Now, before they went down to Egypt, they could. They both had their flocks and herds, but after they got out of Egypt, because the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, had given Abram so much extra wealth on account of Sarah, now they had too much. They couldn't stay in the same area. There wasn't enough grass for all the animals to eat. Verse 7 says, and there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle. So that's not good, because they're related to each other and they liked each other, but their herdmen were arguing because of the limited resources. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. So he gave Lot the first choice. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. A few chapters later, God does destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and it just became a wasteland where nothing would grow. But prior to this, it was a beautiful, lush country there. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And if you read chapter 19 of Genesis, it describes how awful these guys were. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward and southward and eastward and westward, every direction. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. What a great thing to have God tell a person, I'm going to give you everything that you see in every direction. I'm going to give it to you and to your seed, and I'm going to give it to you forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Dust, that's smaller than grains of sand. Said if you can count all the particles of dust, then your seed would be able to be numbered. But of course it can't, and it's something that will continually get bigger and bigger and bigger. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So he built several altars, and at the altar he would offer sacrifices. So as Abram's wealth is increasing from his animals multiplying, from the gift that the king of Egypt had given him, he's taking a portion of that and he's honoring God with these sacrifices. So every place he would build an altar, he would offer sacrifices there. So he's honoring God with his substance. Chapter 14. This is an interesting chapter. It says, and it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. So there was these four kings that made war with these five kings. Among those five kings that were attacked was the king of Sodom. That's where Lot went, right? So he's in trouble. And it says that these five kings served Chedorlaomer and the other kings with him for 12 years. So they made conditions of peace where they would have to give him like tribute money and kind of bow down to him, do whatever he said. But in the 13th year, they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth Karnaim and the Zuzims in Ham and the Emims in Shaveh Kirathaim. Now the word Rephaims, that's the word that means giants. It was an old tribe of giants. So these were big, tall guys. So this Chedorlaomer, I call him the big cheese. He was the head of these four kings that were conquering all these other places. He's taking on big, strong opponents, and he's beating them, you know? Verse 6, and the Horites in the Mount Seir unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to En-Mishphat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. So these are just conquering right and left. And there went out the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboiim and the king of Bela, same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer the king of Elam, and with Tidal king of nations, and Amraphel king of Shinar, and Arioch king of Elasar, four kings with five. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. It was kind of like tar pits. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there. So they were running away from their army, showing great leadership, and they fell down there. And they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. They were confederate with Abram, so they would join forces together if there was trouble. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. He only had 318 guys. Plus Aner and Eshcol, they probably had some servants of their own. But you're talking about an army of probably less than 1,000 people against these conquering kings that are joined together and beating everybody. He divided himself against them, he and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. So they rescued everybody, and it says it's the slaughter. They slaughtered those kings. It says, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the Valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. So very impressive, greatly outnumbered, but completely fearless. And with the help of God, obviously, he defeated those conquering kings and brought all the goods and the people back that were taken captive. Verse 18 says, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. Melchizedek is written of in one of the Psalms and in the book of Hebrews, where it says that Jesus Christ was made high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a Gentile king that was also a priest. When it came to the kingdom of Israel, the kings and the priests were separate. Kings of Judah were all from the tribe of Judah. All of the priests were of the tribe of Levi. And the kings were not allowed to do what the priests were allowed to do. The kings were not allowed to offer sacrifices and burn incense on the altar. That was the job of the priests. There was a very sharp distinction between the two. But here, and this is long before there was the kingdom of Israel, this Melchizedek, he was both king and priest. The name Melchizedek means king of right or righteous king, because the word Zedek in Hebrew means righteous and Melchi means king. So he's righteous king, and he was king of Salem. At the time, Salem was a city called Salem. Later on, hundreds of years later, it would be called Jerusalem. So it was the same place, but he was the king of Salem, and he brought forth bread and wine. He was priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him. He blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all. So this Melchizedek, he recognized that it was God that helped Abram to defeat the enemies. So he blessed Abram in the name of the Most High God, and he blessed the Most High God that had helped Abram. Abram gave him tithes of all. Said, okay, here's someone who's representing God upon the earth and governing his kingdom according to the will of God and being a priest going to God on behalf of the people and blessing people in the name of God. Abram recognized the greatness of this man Melchizedek, and he gave him tithe as a tenth, 10% of all that he had, which kind of set a pattern for the appropriate amount of giving to God for generations after that. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. He said, I'll just be thankful to get the people back. You take all the goods, everything that Chedorlaomer took from us, you keep it as a reward for helping us out. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up my hand, it means I've sworn, unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich. Abram was so dedicated to God, he didn't want to give anybody else in the world credit for making him rich. He didn't want anything that God didn't provide for him. He was not a covetous man. He was not after money. He just wanted to serve God. God had enriched him far beyond what Abraham might have ever asked for, but he wanted to make sure that it was God only that got the credit for Abram being rich. And especially the king of Sodom, because we've already read that the men of Sodom were sinners exceedingly before the Lord. God was not pleased with them. Abram didn't want to have anything to do with all that stuff. So he refused it. But he made a little caveat in verse 24. It says, save only that which the young men have already eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Anor, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So whatever they want, they can keep it. I'm not going to take anything, because nobody's going to get credit for making me rich. Verse 1 of chapter 15 now. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. Now, let me do a compare with you here, because some of these haven't translated that last part a little different. So the Brenton translation, which is translated from the Greek version of the Old Testament, says, After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I shield thee, thy reward shall be very great. Okay? And a lot of the other ones have something very similar, like the LITV. After these things, the word of Jehovah came to Abram in a vision, saying, Do not fear, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward will increase greatly. So God is telling Abram, I'm going to protect you, and I'm going to be your great rewarder. Kind of like what it says in Hebrews 11:6 that a lot of us have memorized, which says, But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Abraham was given as an example of one that was diligently seeking God. We can see how God had rewarded him already with increasing his wealth. You know, when he went down into Egypt and came back, he was very rich in cattle and in silver and in gold, so much that he had to separate from his nephew Lot. And God helped him with the slaughter of the kings so he could redeem his family member. He rescued him and restored everything that belonged to him. Now God appears to him in a vision again. God didn't necessarily talk to him on a daily basis. It gives us the times that God appeared to him in a vision, or that the word of the Lord came to him. So it wasn't daily. It was every now and then. Sometimes there were years in between the times that God would talk with him. But when he did, it was notable, and it was up to Abram to remember everything that God told him. And if there were instructions, he would be responsible for carrying them out. Okay? There are things that might be one-time things he was supposed to do, and other things that he was supposed to do on a daily basis or do all the time. But at this point, said, Don't be afraid, Abram. I'm your shield. I'm going to protect you, and thy exceeding great reward, or your reward is going to be great. You're seeking me. You're doing my will. I'm going to make sure that your reward is going to be great. Now, part of the reward that he had already seen was the increase in wealth, but the other part was, remember in the last chapter, God said, I'm going to make your seed like the dust of the earth, and they're going to inherit this land where you are. North, south, east, and west, it's all going to belong to you and your seed. That would be a reward for Abram following God's instructions and doing what God said, right? If he had stayed back in Ur of the Chaldees, he wouldn't be getting all this. But he was seeking God's will and doing God's will, and God was going to reward him both in the present with a lot of wealth and in the future with his descendants after him that would be like the dust of the earth for number, and living as landowners in this place where Abram was staying as like a resident alien up to that point. Now, Abram said unto God, he said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eleazar of Damascus? So much of what God promised Abram as a reward was that his inheritance would go to his seed that would be so numerous. He's saying, this is all wonderful, God, but at this point in my life, I don't have one child yet. And if I were to die today, the heir to everything I own would be Eleazar of Damascus, who would be the steward of his house, who would be the highest ranking servant, who would be the one responsible for administrating everything, making sure everybody gets fed and has all their needs met. He'd be the top guy. So I'm saying, this is my heir at this point. Verse 3, and Abram said, Behold, look, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. So now the promise is very specific, right? And will get more specific as time goes by. And he brought him forth abroad and said, Look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And he believed in the Lord, and he, the Lord, counted it to him for righteousness. We read that last week in Romans chapter 4, how that righteousness is by believing, giving Abraham as the example of that. But look at this. God had already told Abram about the number of descendants he would have, that his seed would be like the dust of the earth for multitude, right? But now he's showing him the stars in the sky. And he says, look toward heaven and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. Now the word tell and the word number are the same Hebrew word, safar. And it means to count, recount, relate, to count things, to number, taken account of, to reckon, to be counted, be numbered, to recount, rehearse, declare, to recount something or rehearse, to talk, to count exactly or accurately. There's a lot of definitions about counting and enumerating. Now, when you go to the bank, there's a person called the teller, right? It comes from this word here, to count. Now, the teller at the bank, if they're going to count out money, they have to tell the difference between a 1, a 5, a 10, a 20, and a 100. They're not just counting pieces of paper. They have to understand what they're counting and be able to total it up. God is telling Abram to look at the stars. Look now toward heaven and tell the stars. Now, there's been a number of books written about the topic of God's word being written in the stars, okay? The first one is written in the mid-1800s, and it's called the Maseroth, and it was a collection of the names of the stars and the constellations from the Hebrew roots and what they meant. And then there's a couple other books written. One was by E.W. Bullinger called The Witness of the Stars, and that was done in the late 1800s, like 1893. And more recently, in 2017, a friend of mine, Ray Myers, who lives in central Pennsylvania, he studied this, and he wrote a book called Have They Not Heard, okay, by Raymond H. Myers. And I haven't read the whole book through yet, but I've read parts of it. And what he's done is he's looked at the previous books that have been written and checking the accuracy of those things and what they were saying. But let me read something to you from chapter one of this book. He refers to the three other people that had written on this topic. And he said, it is this author's assertion, talking about himself, that the writers of these other books conclude the heavens are making the following broad statement. The promised seed of the woman will come and redeem mankind. The seed of the woman will be bruised and wounded, but it will crush the head of the serpent in final victory, which is really cool. Because when Adam sinned, he disobeyed God. God called him out, you know, Adam and Eve, come here. What have you done? Have you eaten of the tree that I told you not to eat? And Adam said, well, the woman that you gave me, she gave me some to eat and I ate it. And that's what I did. And he called out the woman, what have you done? Well, the serpent, he beguiled me. He kind of tricked me and I ate some of that. And then he talked to the serpent. Said, because you have done this, you're going to go on your belly the rest of your life. You're going to be eating dust. And the seed of the woman is going to crush your head. You're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. And that was the first mention in the Bible of Jesus Christ and what he would do. And if this is true about the word written in the stars, then during those first couple of thousand years before the Bible was put in writing, that God showed those that believed in him the stars, the names of the constellations and significant stars in the group, and it told the story of the seed of the woman that would crush the head of the serpent, you know, and that's how mankind would be redeemed. And the stars would always be there. And according to what he's seen in this book and in the other books that he examined, is that the names of the constellations and of the major stars that are visible, they've been pretty well preserved through the years. And it does make a lot of sense. And there's a lot of verses in the Bible that talk about God making the heavens and calling the stars by name. And I think that's pretty cool. One of the reasons I think this is so cool is what we read last week about when Jesus Christ was talking to those Pharisees, and he made the statement, it was in John chapter 8, that Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. If all this is true about the witness of the stars, then this incident would have been the time that he saw Christ's day. You see that? The seed of the woman crushing the head of the serpent. That would be the day, okay, that he would rejoice. So if God took him out and said, look at the stars, see if you can tell the stars, not just how many there are, but what they say, the story that's written in them, that he would have known. That's something that would be passed down from the fathers to the children, to the grandchildren, and they could show him the stars and say, that's the name of that constellation, this is the name of that one, this is what it means. You know, the promised seed of the woman will be coming. This serpent is going to be taking over the world. The promised seed will be bruised, but will crush the head of that serpent. And they would know that much about it, that there was one coming that would make everything right again, according to the will of God and by the power of God. So if God showed that to Abram and said, so shall thy seed be, meaning that seed of the woman is going to come from you. You see that? What you see written in the stars about that seed of the woman, that is going to come from your body. You know, so among the many, many seeds, the many descendants that you'll have, your collective seed, there will be one that will be that promised seed that will crush the head of the serpent. That would be something that Abraham would rejoice and be glad to see. And for him to believe that, God counted it to him for righteousness. And we've already read in Romans 4 that one thing Abraham believed was that God was able to raise the dead, not only to revitalize his reproductive system, but the promised one. The bruising of that promised seed of the woman would mean he would die and then be raised again. And in being raised again, after that, he would crush the head of that serpent. So I just think that is really, really cool. So I believe this is the point at which Abram saw Christ's day, and he rejoiced to see his day, and he saw it and was glad. And then he believed in the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness, because he believed in the one true God that was able to raise the dead. And he said unto him, God said unto him, I am the Lord, Jehovah, that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? So he had the words of God. He was asking for something tangible, okay? Some tangible thing that he could just hold on to. And he said unto him, take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a he-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, means he cut them lengthwise, and laid each piece one against another, but the birds divided he not. Why would he do this? Well, there was a custom in the lands and times of the Bible, when someone was to make a covenant, that they would take one or more animals and cut them in pieces down the middle and walk in between the pieces of the animals. It's written of elsewhere in the Bible that men have done this. So he cut them in pieces. When the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away, so the vultures would come and he'd chase them off. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. Okay, so he's talking obviously about his descendants going down into Egypt, being slaves there, and God bringing them out again, which will happen in the book of Exodus. And thou, Abram, shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. So Abram had the assurance now that he would live a long time. He was already, at this point, 80-something, I would think, and that he would live a good long time. He would live to 175 years old. And he would go to his fathers. That's a euphemism for dying, like his father and fathers before him were already dead. You're going to go to your fathers in peace. So you're not going to die a violent, painful death. You're going to fall asleep and then wake up again afterwards. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again. It means your descendants will come back here again. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Amorites were some of the people that dwelt in that land. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. So God sent this visual thing to show, I'm making a covenant with you. This is a solemn covenant. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Cadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaims and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. So these are all the different tribes that were living in that land there. He had previously said, I will give you this land. At this point, he says, unto thy seed have I given this land. He's putting in the past tense what is a future event, saying this is going to happen. When God calls something that isn't yet as though it already were, it's a way of saying, you can absolutely count on this. I put it in the past tense because it's absolutely going to happen. So those are the adventures of Abram so far. We'll continue this next week, and we'll see when his name gets changed to Abraham, and when he has the promised son Isaac, and then what happens after that. But all along, Abram is seeking God's will. That's why God's talking to him, because Abram wants to do God's will. God didn't have to beat him over the head and say, look, pay attention here. I'm trying to get you to do something. Every time God would talk to Abram, he was already watching and listening. He was a servant of God. And a trained servant will always be looking at the master for the slightest clue, because he's ready to do whatever the master needs to have done. Abram was like that. He was called a servant of God. And he was a prophet of God, meaning he had the Spirit of God upon him that enabled him to receive revelation so that God could show him things visually and tell him things audibly, because he had that spirit that God could speak to that spirit. The spirit would relay the information to his mind, and he would know what God's will was and the information that God had to give him. And he always carried it out right away. He didn't have to be told twice. God would tell him, he would do it. And that's just the kind of man that God needed to bring his plan to pass. He needed people that would cooperate with him. And Abram, he was God's man. And we're all very thankful for him, and a great example for us who want to diligently seek God ourselves. So that's all for tonight. Thanks for joining in, and we'll see you again next week.